Okay, welcome to what is it first, I think, for those of you who've either been in one or the other. It's a joint seminar between the Early Modern World History Seminar and the South Asian Studies Seminar. I hope we're able to do it again, and so it's great to have an audience from both sides. The two speakers today, in a sense, represent also those worlds. Jean Boutier is, Jean Boutier and Odati Birmani are both at the École des Études en Sciences Sociales in Marseille. Arundhati is a historian of colonial and contemporary India. She's written an extraordinary number of things, both of them have, on cartography, on color, flags, and she's currently working on the aesthetic relationship of the urban environment in contemporary India. Jean is an early modernist and has also written an extraordinary number of things on early modern Italy, early modern France, travel, academies, libraries. So they both represents, in a sense, that both worlds are bringing here together tonight. When they mentioned that they were working on Johann Zoffany, I was thrilled that they were able to come and talk about this together. And I look forward to hearing, we look forward to hearing your talk today. So thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'd like to thank Melissa for inaugurating this collaboration between the two worlds, a very old one, and hopefully now a very harmonious one. And so this is a little collaboration we've sort of engaged in, adding to our other collaborations and collective experience. I hope you will be an indulgent audience because, as many of you know, Johann Zoffany is a very well studied painter, and in fact it's a little foolhardy of us to rush in and into this field, so art critics and greater experts than us, please bear with us. So in August 2014, in fact, on a visit to the summer palace of Tipu Sultan, ruler of Mysore from 1750 to 1799, at Seringapatam, which is in the south of India, in Karnataka, north of Mysore, I came upon a full-length portrait of Tipu Sultan by the German painter Johann Zoffany. It seems slightly incongruous. In fact, looking at it, I think of Foster, a self-portrait of Foster in the princely state of Deva. It's the same face. And I knew Zoffany as a painter who had mostly done conversation pieces of the British in Britain, in Italy, and also in India. And Tipu's portrait seemed to be the odd man out in this overall production. On closer examination, it also seemed to be falsely attributed to Zoffany. It was dated 1780, whereas the German painter arrived at Madras only in 1783. And anyway, how could he have realized a portrait of the arch enemy of the British, who had already fought two wars against them and was actively plotting a third war? The final proof seemed to be that this portrait did not at all resemble the portraits of Tipu painted by Indian or other British artists. It might seem a little twisted to begin this conference on Zoffany's depiction of the British in Tuscany and in India by showing you his painting of a non-Britisher, but it brings us to the core of the issue. This painter, whose production is mainly linked to official commissions by royalty or by elites, sometimes takes forms of liberty that extend to his depicting the British without any indulgence, but without any satirical attitude either. It is in this in-between position that Zoffany stands out as an interesting case to examine the depiction of the British abroad. At a time when reflections were being developed about the differences between peoples, culminating in the elaboration of the idea of national characters by thinkers as famous as David Hume or Immanuel Kant, Zoffany offers a subtle insight into the representation of the British in different contexts. Today, we're going to examine two specific moments of his activity when he lived in Florence, sent there by Queen Charlotte, wife of George III, and then some years later when he went to India as an East India Company painter. Our analysis will focus on two paintings. Both are well known, well studied. The famous Tribuna of the Uffizi, today in the Royal Collection at London, and Colonel Mordaunt's Cockmatch at the Tate Gallery, also in London. In 1931, chairing a presentation on Sofony by Sir William Forster, former historiographer at the India Office, at the Royal Society of Arts, Sir Charles Holmes, former director of the National Gallery, observed, I quote, "It is rather curious that one who was not an Englishman by birth should have left us what, in a way, were some of the most veracious pictures of contemporary English life that we possess, more veracious than the work of English-born painters of his time." And he said, quote, "When he had found his feet and begun to paint English county society, Sofony had done so with a curious phlegm which was not quite English. His vision was very observant and very minute. It might be said that he painted without any warm sympathy and perhaps without any very great enthusiasm, but with the eye of a most interested and scrupulous experimentalist. His had been a methodical and scientific vision rather than an enraptured one." This judgment encourages us in our project and invites us to displace our gaze from his representations of the British at home to the British in foreign contexts. The comparison between Tuscany and India is not habitual, despite the current Bollywood actors and middle class fascination with Tuscany, but a certain number of elements justify it. Sofony spent more or less the same time in both places, around 5 years. He was dependent on royal or official patronage, and the two paintings we examine today lend themselves to comparison. So who exactly was Sofony? The first aspect we could recall here is his mobile career. Born near Frankfurt in 1733 as Johannes Josephus Sofaly to a Catholic court cabinet maker and architect of Alexander Ferdinand, Prince of Thurn and Taxis, Sofony studied painting at Regensburg with Martin Speer, a provincial German artist who himself had trained in Italy with Francesco Solimena, the Napolitan painter. In 1750, he left for Italy, stayed at Rome, visited Naples and Venice. At Rome, he trained in the workshop of Agostino Masucci, who was painting for British clients and had amongst his students another Scottish painter, Gavin Hamilton, as well as Pompeo Batoni, very well-known portrait maker. This is the very moment when Joshua Reynolds was in Rome. We have no proof, however, that Sofony frequented all these people. After a brief return trip to Germany in 1753, he came back to Rome, working now with a German painter, Anton Raphael Mengs. While in Italy, he also Italianized his name, making it Sofony. Perhaps this was to distinguish himself from the Italian bronze sculptor then working in Rome, Giacomo Zoffoli. In 1757, he again returned to Regensburg and was rapidly recruited in court and as cabinet painter of Johann Philipp, Graf von Walterdorf, the prince, archbishop, and elector of Trier. But in 1760, he resigned and left for London in the autumn of 1760. And in England, he adopted what would be his definite name, Sofony. All these details merely to show you how terribly mobile he was, but this mobility was very common. It was very necessary for artists to travel for their training, but also for commissions. Travel was part of the formula for making reputations and a profit. So artists planned their routes according to the profitable welcomes they might expect. They functioned within an international orbit, spoke many European languages, and were quite a cosmopolitan group. This was true also of musicians, engineers, scientists, astronomers, writers. Kant is certainly an astonishing exception. For as Stephen Greenblatt reminds us, the picture we have of people simply in their places, in cultures that weren't in contact, is simply wrong. A quick recall of some of the big artists of the period underlines their transnational movements and affiliations. Rubens perfectly illustrated this mobility. Flemish origins, extended sojourns, and working experience in Italy, England, France, and Germany. A century later, Handel offered another perfect example. Dozens of other names could be cited. So Fanny was not an exception as a German. He was doing what a lot of German artists did. European society was not only a mobile economy of goods and services, but also culturally open. Can one talk of it being cosmopolitan? Or does the term not lend itself to some confusion? We'll come back to this point a little later. London, of course, where Zoffany arrived, was an undeniable magnet, a tempting market open to an aspiring German artist. His success in introducing himself into London artistic circles, academies, aristocratic society is very well documented. He was actively promoted by the famous theater personality David Garrick. The ultimate recognition, of course, was by the royal family in 1764, whose German origins, no doubt, worked to Zoffany's advantage. In 1769, George III favored him with a direct nomination to the Royal Academy of Arts, founded just a year earlier, without the usual balloting of its members. In 1772, finally, Queen Charlotte commissioned him to paint the Tribuna, the octagonal room in the Uffizi Gallery in Florence that contained the most precious items of the Medici collections. The commission was born of the royal desire to develop the British monarch's own art collection on the lines of the Grand Duke of Tuscany. Zoffany was to produce from direct observation a faithful depiction of all the oeuvre d'art in the Tribuna.
In Florence, he was introduced to George Nassau Clavering, 3rd Earl Cowper, a rich British patron of art and collector living in Florence in 1760, and to the Grand Duke Peter Leopold himself. His entry into the artistic circle of the city was confirmed by his very rapid election, 2 weeks after his arrival, to the Accademia del Disegno on the 19th of August, 1772. Zoffany immediately began work on the painting, hoping to complete it by March 1774. But he was still working on it in 78 and would only finish it in 79. The Tribuna of the Uffizi, London, the Royal Collection, is one of the most well-known pieces produced by the German painter. I think it's more or less the correct size, which is about 1.20 meters, 1.50 meters, the real painting. It shows some 20 men in 4 unequal groups, deeply engaged in examining and discussing works of art, ranging from antique sculptures, Roman, Etruscan, in even Egyptian. I guess I can use my finger. A little higher. Okay, sorry. Two famous paintings of the Flemish and Italian Renaissance, both Venetian and Florentine. This intense exchange is taking place within the Tribuna, an octagonal room designed by Buontalenti for Francis I of Medici in 1584 in the well-known Uffizi Gallery in Florence. Exceptionally, the most famous masterpieces of the collections of the great Duke of Tuscany had been intentionally assembled here for Zoffany's painting. In the forefront, on your right side, a group of 6 senior gentlemen are gathered around Titian's famous Venus of Urbino. To the left, a younger group studies Raphael's Madonna, so-called Niccolini Cowper, held by Zoffany himself. We'll look at it a little later. In the background, 2 young men stands before the satyr with symbols, just over there. Whilst to the right, yet another group circles around Venus of Medici, on the right, the extreme right. 2 visitors to the left are studying the statues of Cupid and Psyche. One of the younger gentlemen in the group at the left is applying himself to the established academic exercise of making a sketch in a little notebook. The swords attached to their dresses are the ensign of royal and princely orders, their silk gilet and stockings, velvet culotte and duster coats, buckled shoes and wigs indicate the social status of the visitors. The postures of the gentlemen and their examination of the precious artworks reserved the viewing for viewing for those of high rank mark them out as connoisseurs participating in a new cultural activity increasingly adopted by elite in the course of the 18th century. This was going to a museum and the collective discussion about works of art between friends or peers. Indeed, in Florence, the Uffizi was the principal hub for travelers of the Grand Tour. This gallery, noted Richard Nugent in one of the main English guidebooks of the 18th century, the famous Grand Tour published in 1749, this gallery is the admiration of all travelers for the great variety it contains of statues and pictures by the best hands. Despite the appearance of the painting as a realistic photograph of a real visit by a group of British visitors, the Tribuna is an artistic fiction. It puts together Britishers who probably never visited the Uffizi at the same time, but who were actually in Florence in the 1770s. Art historian Oliver Miller has identified most of the spectators who finally appeared in the painting. For example, the group looking at the Raphael's Madonna includes Lord Cooper of the first with the brown gilet, Sir John Dick, who was at this time the British consul at Leghorn, wearing the Russian Order of St. Anne of Schleswig-Holstein, other Hickman Windsor, 5th Earl of Plymouth, who stayed in Florence for some months in 1772, Zoffany himself, holding the painting, Mr. Stevenson and George Ledge, who were traveling together and stopped over in Florence in late 77, beginning 1778. Early 1778. Without going into all the details, the composition of the whole group is clearly visible. We find here the key actors of the British presence in Tuscany. Sir Horace Mann, who was for at least half a century the British resident in Florence. We have just seen the British consul at Leghorn. George Nassau Clavering, 3rd Earl Cooper, a very rich British patron of art and collector, living in Florence since 1760. Beside them, we find two artists working in Florence at the time, Zoffany, of course, himself, and Charles Lorraine Smith, an amateur painter. The others were all British travelers on their grand tour. They included both members of the upper aristocracy, members of the peerage, but also members of the lower gentry and some middle-class figures. Florence was indeed an important stage in the British Grand Tour since the beginning of the 18th century, not before. The only local Italian is Pietro Bastianelli, standing behind Titian's Venus of Urbino. At the time, he was one of the senior custodi, keeper, or guide of the gallery. In fact, he fulfills the necessary function of the local expert guiding the visit, indispensable for transforming this fiction into a realistic conversation piece, a genre that had become very fashionable in England at the time. The painting was received critically in England. When Zoffany finally returned in the summer of 1778, he left Florence at this time, already the rare echoes we find amongst Italians were reserved. Giuseppe Pelli Bencivenni, a central figure in the Florentine artistic intellectual circus, was the director of the Gallery of the Uffizi. He was also the director of the Novelle Letterarie, one of the principal Italian literary weeklies of the time. So in this exclusive select gathering of Britishers, I quote his diary, una folla di spettatori ritratti al naturale in piccole figure, specialmente forestieri. Translated, crowd of spectators portrayed in nature mainly foreigners, thus clearly underlying the distance between them and Florentine society. In England, criticism was even more severe. Already, Sir Horace Mann, the British resident in Florence, writing to Horace Walpole, found the painting, I quote, too much crowded with, for the most part, uninteresting portrait of English travelers than here. We have the heart of the reproaches leveled at the Dauphiné. The Queen had ordered a representation of the most famous princely art collection of Europe, the Medici collection, inherited by the new dynasty. She expected more certainly the presence of the Grand Duke, Peter Leopold and his family, perhaps surrounded by some local artistic key figures. I've evoked the figure of Peli Bencivenni. I could evoke another important figure, the figure of Luigi Lanzi, who was a Jesuit, professor of Greek, and famous archaeologist, and then later famous author of an Italian art history, who was appointed keeper of the gallery in 1773 and became a little later the president of the famous Accademia della Crusca. First, 2 points, I would say, to summarize this analysis. First, in a certain way, Zoffany presented Britishers behaving in a way that did not exactly correspond to their own representations. Beyond this criticism, the Grand Tour was a practice that was aimed at discovering the diversity of European societies, manners, and cultures. It was also, for the travelers, a way of creating networks with foreign elite. On the contrary, the painting presented the Britishers amongst themselves, without practically no links with local society, self-satisfied and self-contained, speaking their own language, we can presume, and constructing the figure of the British connoisseur. It corresponded to a series of criticism levels against the Grand Traveller. While the excessive satire of the Italianate since the myth of the 16th century, called later Macaron in the 18th century, while this excessive figure was strongly condemned, at the same time, fathers and tutors expected their sons and wards to develop personal strong exchanges with their local European counterparts, facilitated by a good knowledge of the major European languages. On the contrary, the painting illustrates the difference in what certain observers had underlined about British behaviors when abroad, like Dr. John Moore, a British tutor accompanying 2 young gentlemen on their continental tour at the same time, the late 1770s. I quote, "Of all travelers, the English in general frequently shew unjust prejudices against the people among whom they sojourn. They despise their country and their customs. They form, if possible, societies and clubs of their own. By this illiberal way of thinking and acting, the true purpose of traveling is lost and perverted. And many Englishmen have remained 4 or 5 years abroad without having mixed with the natives of the country through which they passed. Yet, to travel to France or Italy and to converse with none but English people and to have merely to boast of having been in those countries is certainly absurd to the highest degree." They were even perceived as converging to hotels famous for serving up everything, I quote, the observation of the Grand Tour by Hustler Lynch Piozzi, published at the end of the 1780s, hotels famous for serving up everything in the English manner, from beds and pillows to currant tarts and bacon. Second point I would like to underline, Zoffany had presented very briefly two motley crowd to please a class, a very class-conscious British society. He was accused of mercenary reasons. People would have paid them to be in the painting, which would have allowed ordinary travelers to find a place on a prestigious painting commissioned by the Queen herself, beside the highest member of the aristocracies, whom they couldn't have approached at home. Were such contacts really possible during the Grand Tour? Zoffany certainly gave this impression.
Flouting the principal social codes and rules of British society had come at a cost. Out of favor with the British monarchs, they weren't very keen on paying Zoffany. Reeling under debt, the painter sought to restore his fortune elsewhere. India, fabled for her riches, offered a way out for a painter hopeful of making his fortune. Artists like Tilly Kettle, the first professional painter who visited India from 1769 to the beginning to 1776, or George Willison, who had recently returned from Bengal in 1781, had been particularly successful in winning princely patronage. So in 1782, Zoffany submits a petition to the East India Company asking for permission to proceed to India to exercise the profession of a painter. Once in India in July 1783, his introduction into Anglo-Indian society was smooth and rapid. His reputation as a painter who had been particularly favored by royal patronage opened the doors of Calcutta's snobbish British social circles. The next year, he became member of the Asiatic Society of Bengal, recruited by William Jones, its founder. The 4.5 years he spent in India led him from the company-administered capital of Bengal, Calcutta, to Lucknow, the princely capital of Awadh, still a province of the Mughal Empire, but also a state where 10 years earlier, in 1773, the British had posted their resident in order to consolidate their political control over northern India. The colonial context was far removed from the Italian world of high culture and art, where the British lived and socialized strictly in their own small world of expatriates. In India, even if they clustered in the narrow society of white people, they were necessarily led to mingle with Indian elites and princes, or called upon to participate in courtly life and rituals. The 18th century was an age of British expansion in India through military wars, conquests, commercial inroads, but equally through negotiations, plots, and parleys with Indian rulers whose territories the British coveted. As in England or in Italy, Zoffany was commissioned to paint large conversation pieces for some prominent British families, focusing on their homes and their rituals of sociability. His overall artistic production in India is estimated at 190 drawings and sketches. His portraits and family conversation pieces, in fact, read like a list of who's who. They depict men of status and power, the Governor General Warren Hastings, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, military commanders, but also important members of the civil services. I'm going to concentrate here only on one painting that could be approached as an equivalent of the Florentine Tribuna in a similar situation. This is Colonel Mordaunt's Cockmatch, painted in 1784 to 86, commissioned by the Governor General Warren Hastings. It's more or less the same size as the Tribuna, about 1.5 meters. It represents an uncommon, equally informal situation. It's also very different from other British artistic depictions in India, which either present the British in positions of power or the natives in exoticized frames. The moment when Zoffany received the commission was, however, strategically more critical as compared to the order of the Tribuna. Hastings was himself spending 5 months in Lucknow in the hope of drawing the Kingdom of Awadh into the orbit of the East India Company and improving Anglo-Indian relations. This rich kingdom that resisted both the Marathas and the British was strategically important, for it was placed, it would give the British control of the fertile plain between the Ganges and the Yamuna rivers. Hastings recruited Zoffany as a means to approach some key political figures through informal audiences with the Nawab and with the heir to the Mughal throne, who had fled to Avad to take refuge there. The painting represents a cockfight, a popular pastime at court in Mughal India, as well as in more modest circles. From the British perspective, the cockfight was not such an exotic sport, though never very well viewed, too associated with the lower classes and far removed from the more refined activities like dancing or even swordsmanship. Cockfighting had nevertheless always attracted the aristocracy. Henry VIII had a cockpit built in the Palace of Whitehall, elevating this sport above its usual lower class locations. In the 18th century, cockfighting was thus a major component of elite sociability, along with horse racing and bowling. Tsofany unfolds this event under a large tent, a shamiana, and more specifically in an inner circle clearly demarcated within the canvas. The stakes of this cockfight are not forcibly those analyzed by Clifford Getz in his equally famous Balinese cockfight. Outside, the crowd is engaged in the usual activities which characterize a gathering or a festive occasion, with a group of musicians, a water seller, an elephant in the background, a dozen roosters are waiting in the wings to enter the arena. Under the tent, the space is exclusively masculine, peopled by Indian courtiers and Britishers. Tsofany has assembled the principal actors of British political strategy in Lucknow, all of whom were not necessarily attending the event on 5th April 1784. As in the Tribuna, therefore, Tsofany introduced the British officers and officials of the East India Company a posteriori. Its resident and his assistant in Lucknow, the postmaster, the accountant, and senior merchants. The painting is centered, as you see, on two confrontations between a couple of roosters managed by their Indian owners or assistants in the forefront. In the center of the painting, we see the Nawab Asafuddaulah, and to the right, and Colonel Mordaunt, a natural son of the Earl of Peterborough, and the commander of the Nawab's bodyguard. They're facing each other. And Colonel Mordaunt was also in charge of organizing all the extracurricular activities for the Nawab. And slightly behind them, but appearing between them, is the Nawab's uncle, Salar Jung, and then looking over the shoulder is the Nawab's minister, Hazan Razak Khan. The central figures of the Lucknow court are portrayed here. We also have Colonel Antoine Poulier in a red coat, standing under the awning. This is a Swiss officer who was engineer to the Nawab and had married several Indian ladies. Again, as in the Tribuna, Tsofany has placed himself in the painting.
On the
right. Voila, in the right-hand corner. He's seated with his arm over the back of his chair. And to his right is a fellow artist, Ozias Humphrey. There is also Colonel Claude Martin, a former French officer who had gone over to the service of the East India Company and had settled in Awadh, developing a rich trade and patronizing the arts. It's a very famous La Martinière College in Lucknow still. And he's seated on a sofa to the right of the group. In the right-hand bottom corner, standing holding a cock is Robert Gregory, assistant to the British resident at Lucknow. And then we have John Bombwell, who is seated to the right. Despite the immediate mixity of the group, a closer look at this painting reveals all the Britishers clustered on the right side in four small groups. Beyond the representation of a collective participation in the cockfight as a shared spectacle, a closer examination of the painting shows the different forms of separation between the two groups. The British, identified mostly by their uniforms, are on the right side of the painting. Conversations shown in the painting are being conducted exclusively by the Britishers amongst themselves. So too for the Indians. The only element that troubles this order is the respective position of the two central figures, Mordaunt on the left, on the Indian side, and Asafuddaulah, the Nawab, on the right side, the British side. These are the only two inter-ethnic conversations. One taking place between Mordant and the Nawab. A second exchange appears to be an unidentifiable transaction, which is taking place between a British officer and an Indian in the to the right of the painting. This painting presents a typical example of living together separately. Mordant and another European seated to the right are holding a rooster, and some of the Britishers, you can see, are wearing Indian juti slippers. So one of them is smoking a hookah. And this, these small elements refer to broader cultural practice. Certain Britishers had Indian wives, so did Sofani himself. And princes had their portraits drawn by European artists. Without repeating the art historians or literary critics' various interpretations of this painting in terms of either deep play or the phantasmatic image of the Eastern other, or even the subliminal deployment of sexual hierarchy to delegitimize the Indian ruler, I'd like to draw attention to the subtle blurring of distinctions between the Britishers here, or the Frenchmen, or the Swiss. Claude Martin discusses with the Britisher, who is waiting for the next cock match to begin. Poulier, the Swiss military engineer, stands dominating the scene and the whole group of Britishers. Other paintings of Tsofany similarly show the close ties and exchanges between Europeans of different nationalities living in Lucknow in the second half of the 18th century. Contrary to the strong separations between British travelers and local society that Tsofany had suggested through the Tribuna, in India, he presents an impression of certain proximities and continuities between Britishers, Europeans, and Indians in an Indian state before its formal colonization. Tsofany then can be seen as serving a means to question the standard statement about the distinctiveness of nationalities, their social and cultural discontinuities which were being developed in the 18th century. Let's come back to some observations by Dr. Moore, which Jean Boutier already quoted. Coming back from his tour of the continent, Dr. Moore was writing, "Is the Englishman abroad is as different from a Frenchman or an Italian as an English mastiff is from a monkey or a fox. And if ever that sedate and plain-meaning dog should pretend to the gay friskiness of the one or to the subtlety of the other, we should certainly value him much less than we do." Here is an undiluted plea for the virtues of displaying Britishness as opposed to any other national traits. David Hume went as far as decontextualizing these national characteristics, claiming that they were universal. I quote, "The same set of manners will follow a nation and adhere to them over the whole globe, as well as the same laws and language." In the same spirit, Jean-Jacques Rousseau added a further normative dimension. "La première règle que nous avons à suivre est le caractère national. Tout peuple a ou doit avoir un caractère national, et si l'on manquait, il faudrait commencer par le lui donner." The first rule to be followed is the national character. Every people has or should have a national character, and in its absence, one would have to begin by giving them one.
As you have seen, we tried to analyze, present, and maybe discuss some important questions the historians are dealing with today. And to summarize these observations, we tried to present some broad arguments using Tsofany's paintings: question of mobility, cultural transfer, connectivity, cosmopolitanism, the problem of continuities and discontinuities, both in Tsofany's works and in the relationship between the British and other, let's say, indigenous societies, whether Italian or Indian. Obviously, the last questions around that he dealt with also arises if there is a link between the social behaviors observed in specific contexts that Zofany represents and national characteristics. To answer this, we wouldn't need to go into recent literature about the production of national typologies during the 18th century. Without going into such a detailed discussion here, what is Zofany showing us through these two paintings? Maybe more than highlighting the British national character as a category and a historical reality, largely discussed by thinkers of the Enlightenment, Zofany depicts British behaviors and forms of sociability as constructed in response to specific situations or contexts. In Europe, Britishers tried to distinguish themselves from other Europeans, asserting a national distinctiveness that would be strongly accentuated in times of war on the continent. In India, on the contrary, pragmatic considerations led them to engage with native societies and even sometimes abandon their strict coded patterns of politeness. To conclude then, Zofany's mobility makes him out to be what we today call a global actor in the artistic and political world. We've shown the map: Regensburg, Rome, Trier, London, Florence, Vienna, back to Florence, London, Madras, Calcutta, Awad, Lucknow, London. The connection he made and the transfers he was accomplishing, for example, using the model of the conversation piece in very different contexts, could lead us to consider Zofany from the unique perspective of continuity. We could very well compare the family portraits he realized in Tuscany, in English counties, or in London, and in India. From this point of view, the painter is working with uniform, accepted, and recognized artistic models and aesthetic canons. At the same time, the discontinuity is introduced by the logic of the local context and the interference of other foreign actors and imperatives. Beyond these well-established categories that would deserve a longer discussion, obviously, it's a certain form of liberty, despite the constraints of the different commissions by princes or by English companies abroad, that underlined Zofany, that gave Zofany a capacity of acute observation and perhaps demonstrate his slightly ironic gaze, not satirical like Hogarth, being both inside, as we have seen on the paintings, and obviously outside the representation, to be able to paint the portraits and views, both participant and observer of the British abroad from a British, non-British point of view. Thank you very much for your attention.